Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today is a cartoonist, illustrator, editor, and political pundit, best known for the 1990s comic book Hate. He also edited the Weirdo comics anthologies back in the 80s and went on to author a series of illustrated biographies, including Rebel Woman, Fire, and Credo. Peter Bagg, it's a real pleasure to have you back in the studio.
Oh, well, thanks a lot. Great to be here.
You have been pretty busy lately, working with DC Comics on a couple of projects and drawn on Quarterly on some graphic biographies, but a lot of comics readers still remember you as the creator of Buddy Bradley, the star of Hate and Neat Stuff comics back in the 1990s.
That's right, back from the former century. But yeah, it probably is what I'm still best known for.
And yeah, you've actually continued to follow the adventures of Buddy Bradley and his circle. You've taken him from a sullen teenage pot dealer in New Jersey to a Seattle grunge impresario, and then back east where he became something of a working class icon.
Yeah, all through the 90s, I spent almost all my time working on Hate comics, and which was stories about Buddy Bradley. Towards the end of the decade, I was getting all these opportunities that were too good not to take advantage of. And I never wanted to just work on one character for my whole life. So ever since then, I've been doing all kinds of things, all different things. But I still wanted to keep that Buddy Bradley character alive. So at least all through the aughts, every year I would put out a Hate annual, which would have like a short Buddy Bradley story. I just wanted to keep his heart pumping, so to speak. And I still had a lot of story ideas for him, but the readers didn't see. I made him older. Now he's married. He has a kid. He's pursuing very uncool, unromantic professions like scrap metal collecting and dealing. So not surprisingly, a lot of the former Hate readers lost interest. Sales kept going down. So I was like, all right, enough. If nobody's going to buy this thing, I'm not going to keep doing it. Although I still had plenty of ideas for him. And people still will seem, it seems like a reflective or a reactionary question, like something just to ask me. I don't know if they're serious or not, but I'm frequently asked if I'm going to revive Buddy Bradley. And the answer is, I don't know. Maybe one day, but I'm not feeling, there's not much reason. There's certainly no economic reason to revive them.
Well, yeah, I mean, all of the Gen X readers nowadays, you know, they're happy to look back on their misspent youth, maybe in the Pacific Northwest, but it's kind of hard to look at the realities of raising a family and doing a day-to-day job nowadays, I suppose.
Yes. Unfortunately, the demographic that buys alternative comics, they tend to be in their 20s, you know, I'd say like between 18 and early 30s. And once you reach that point that you have a spouse and children and a mortgage and you become much more career focused, going to the local alternative comic shop really becomes a very low priority. And meanwhile, if you do comics that reflect your own life, you know, being I'm 61 now, doing comics that reflect the life I'm living now and my own experiences, that simply doesn't interest that core comic buying audience. 20-somethings, they don't want to read about their dad or their granddad even.
You kind of moved out. You live in Tacoma now, but you moved out to Seattle at the beginning of kind of the Northwest comics boom and when Fantagraphics was still a struggling publisher. And you really kind of set the tone along with folks like Charles Burns. What was it like to be considered the grunge artist back in the 90s?
Well, yeah, I moved to Seattle in 1984. And there were just a few cartoonists living in Seattle, and they barely hung out with each other. My wife loves to host parties, and so we would force all these people to socialize. See, I don't, maybe Portland was the same way back then, or still is, but it was like a city of hermits. People really kept to themselves. There wasn't,
introverts, huh?
Yes, there wasn't really much of a scene. When we'd say, let's all get together, their response was usually, why? But Seattle then, just like Portland, it was a great place for an artist to move. If you did something where it didn't matter which city you were living in, why not Seattle? It used to be cheap back then, amazingly. So it wasn't surprising that more and more artists and writers and cartoonists and musicians started moving in. And that is, and then a handful of them, especially musicians, suddenly became superstars, which brought a lot more attention to Seattle.
Before you moved to Seattle, when you were a student at School of Visual Arts and hanging out in New York, you actually did a lot of underground publishing yourself with friends and associates in punk magazines, in low circulation fanzines.
Right. Yeah, the first thing I had a hand in self-publishing, it was a comic tabloid called Comical Funnies. And I did that with people who used, prior to that, was doing Punk Magazine, which went out of business. So they had some experience. And it was interesting. He had, at least with the first issue, we put out three issues. But with the first issue, because of punk, he had connection with New York-based distributors. So when that first issue came out, I actually saw it everywhere. It was like, I remember there was a pile of 50 of them at a newsstand in Penn Station. And I worked at a bookstore in Penn Station, so I walked past this newsstand, and I saw, I didn't even bring it there, I just saw this huge, gigantic pile of Comical Funnies. Like I said, it had to have been 50 of them, and then when my work shift was done and I went home, every single one of them sold. So I was like, boy, this, if everybody would just carry this thing, I guess we would have done pretty well.
It could
have
sold. Well, the hook was in your mouth, man.
Yes, but, you know, but then it, each issue after that, it seemed like it kept selling worse.
Well, one thing that came of your publishing history with zines like Punk Magazine is that Robert Crumb, the legendary Robert Crumb, handed you the keys to Weirdo Magazine
Kingdom, yes.
Back in the 80s, late 80s. And the two of you hadn't even met face-to-face at the time. Yeah. The story that I've heard is that you sent him some of your work from the New York punk zines and
Other things. Yeah, we used to send him the magazines. When Weirdo came out...
And he considered you the least neurotic artist that he knew of.
Something like, yeah, that's what he told. I didn't understand because I wasn't very experienced, and we had never met, but just from our communications, he just decided that I seemed fairly reasonable. Like, reliable, I guess, is what he was looking for. So yeah, so I was the managing editor of Weirdo Magazine, which, for listeners who don't know, it was like an underground comics anthology that lasted all through the 1980s.
Some amazing people in there.
Yes, and there is I have to plug it, Last Gasp, who was the publisher of Weirdo, they put out this 300-page book all about Weirdo Magazine. The author, John B. Cook, he tried to track down every single person that ever contributed anything to Weirdo Magazine. And it's a fascinating book. Yeah, so it's called The Book of Weirdo. So if you're interested in that very bizarre time period, it's definitely worth looking at.
Yeah, that was kind of in this strange little trough between the underground comics of the 60s and 70s and then the later alternative comics of the 90s and aughts.
Right. It was a very strange time because it was the 1980s and Ronald Reagan was elected president twice. There was a bit of a backlash from the me decade of the 70s, so to speak. I'm speaking in very general terms and I'm using all these generalizations that lots of sociologists use and overuse. But what I do recall, as someone who wanted to do underground comics and as someone who was into at least what at the time was more underground music, by the late 70s I was into punk and new wave music, which the average American was not into. It wasn't massively popular at all. There suddenly became this really big divide compared to the 70s. There was a big divide between mainstream culture and underground culture. And everything, almost everything that I was interested in and that most of my friends and colleagues and peers were interested in, both making and consuming, was really shunted off into these far corners. And that would include something like Weirdo Magazine. It was hard to find. And if I'd go into like what used to be mainstream bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Borders, places like that, I couldn't find anything that I wanted to read. I'd have to go, it usually would be like in a college town or some downtown part of a major city where you could find a bookstore or a comic shop that sold all this weird stuff. And it was very frustrating as a cartoonist. As I was trying to develop my career all through the 80s, I hardly made any money. You know, I don't think it was until 1989 that I made a five-figure income off of my comics. So it was a real struggle, and I really used to think, this is useless. This is going nowhere. And it used to be prosecuted. Comic shops, bookstores, even cartoonists, they used to... Comic shop clerks, they were always getting arrested. There really was this active suppression, this censorship going on at the time. But the above ground and the underground all collided by the early 90s. And the grunge phenomenon, Nirvana, that did have a lot to do with it. That made a lot of people, that made people living in the suburbs, especially, you know, teenagers and college kids, that made them wonder, where the heck did this come from? And made them interested in punk, like an old school punk, you know. It suddenly was like a lot of people who never would have paid attention, because, mainly because they were unaware. They wanted to know where all of this came from. So then alternative comics exploded. None of us ever got rich, except for Matt Groening. But but we all suddenly were making a living doing our comics. Not, I shouldn't say all of us, but a lot of us suddenly were, which seemed to, it was, seemed like that was unthinkable at a certain point before then. The only reason I stuck with it all through the 80s is I didn't know how to do anything else, you know? And my wife, to her credit, she just kept telling me, stick with it. Don't worry about it. Just stick with it. I want to read what you're going to draw, so just keep doing it. And then also, right at the same time my career took off, our first child was born. And the plan was, since my wife had her business and her business was doing well, the plan was that I would be the primary caregiver. I'd be a stay-at-home dad. And then... do comics when I could. So that when Hate Comics started, all day long I was taking care of an infant until my wife got home. And I had to draw all those comics at night. And then all of a sudden they were selling well. So both me and my wife were like, well, now what do we do? We're both making a decent amount of money. And but then by that time, but partly because we had a kid, my wife was eager to sell her business. So and then I was able to devote myself full time to the comics.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Conser, and my guest today is illustrator, editor, and comics artist Peter Bagg. Another time when you've worn your editor hat, you've been a cartoonist and contributing editor for Reason magazine, the libertarian magazine, for almost 20 years now.
Yeah.
So, you know, in that time, libertarianism has kind of changed. Do you see a divide between kind of the 20th century libertarianism of Russell Means and Frank Zappa and modern 21st century libertarianism?
Well, the principle of it is still roughly the same. I'm sneaking in a plug. I have a brand new biography out called Credo. And
right.
It's about an author named Rose Wilder Lane, who's best known as the daughter of Laura Ingalls Wilder. And she when she was young, she was a socialist, but she started to change her mind about her political beliefs after going to Eastern Europe and seeing the beginnings of the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc, and just seeing how they would how they governed, and it made her reevaluate how she looked upon everything. Personally, she was an anarchist. She was against government, period. But she also knew that that wouldn't work. Like, humanity wasn't ready for pure anarchy yet. So she and other people who she was peers with, they would write these polemics that pretty much defined what became known as modern American libertarianism, the limited government, and the reasons for limited government, and why not to put so much blind faith and trust in government, and especially the federal government. And it isn't, this is the biggest problem that I have with people who have like a negative impression of libertarianism, where they just feel like, well, if you're against this, that, and the other government program, like if you're critical of or think we should get rid of the Department of Education, that means you're against education. And that's not at all the truth. It's not, has nothing to do with not caring. It's just there are other ways to tackle these problems. There are other ways to approach and solve these problems. It doesn't always have to be the federal government creating a new bureaucracy or throwing even more money at this problem. And then not miraculously, the problem still persists. It just becomes a much more expensive problem. So it's just all about, especially if people could do it on their own, having more faith in your fellow humans to solve their problems or solve their community problems rather than have the government step in, have Big Brother step in and treat everybody like all these adults, like infants, you know, for doing things that somebody decided they shouldn't be allowed to do. And that also extends to, you know, the mass incarceration, which is something that I write a lot about with reason, just criminalizing everything, especially, you know, so-called victimless crimes, drugs, prostitution. I have a major problem. I think all of those things should be legal. I believe in open borders. The idea that somebody is an illegal human just because of what piece of land they're standing on the planet Earth. You can stand on this plot of land, but you can't stand on this better plot of land where you can get a better job. Like when somebody says, you know, some Mexicans, they seem to refuse to learn to speak English and become full Americans. It's like, well, if that's the case, I guess that means that I don't have to fully embrace their culture and learn Spanish if I don't feel like it, you know?
Well, that's why I'm thinking that you and Rose Wilder Lane are more in that camp of old school libertarianism where there was this similarity to anarchism. I mean, I mentioned Frank Zappa and Russell Means. They were interested in legalizing victimless crimes, right, prostitution, pot smoking. Yeah, nowadays, libertarian tech bros seem more interested, in the words of playwright Jeff Dorchin, in turning the world into a desert slave planet. I mean, you look at Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. He seems unclear on the distinction between machines and human workers.
I've never heard. You're saying that there are people who advocate?
Well, you know, like the Paul Ryan types, they call themselves libertarians. Yeah. They call themselves libertarians.
He sure didn't govern as one, though. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of people would say, you know, well, especially the phrase that drives me crazy is when somebody says, I'm a libertarian, but, and then the words that come after but prove that the person who said that is not a libertarian at all. Paul Ryan, you know, like a lot of people, he read Ayn Rand and felt inspired by it. And her books might have inspired him to go into politics. But once he was in office, and this happens a lot, sadly, once he was in office, he did not govern as a libertarian at all. At all. There was nothing remotely libertarian about the way he governed, you know?
And the tech bros also don't want to be taxed at all. But let's face it, the internet was created over decades of enormous government investment.
Well, I don't know how much is enormous, but for people doing to tax people who are, for example, doing business over the internet, who exactly is going to do the taxing? You know, that's a real mess. And then with taxes, then you have to ask a bigger question, is where are these taxes going? More people than ever across the board, it doesn't matter what their ideology is, or most likely they don't have one, more people than ever are not paying their income tax. Everybody's ignoring the IRS, mainly because of the lack of trust in the IRS and all this crazy bullshit that our government is spending money on, these wars that don't end. How can you blame anybody if you're not paying taxes when we have all these wars that never, ever end, and droning these countries that were not even officially at war with, and ICE. We're doing so many things. It's not like we're becoming a police state. We are a police state. Have you gone to a Major League Baseball game? To get into a comic convention I went to in Seattle, I had to go through all that security theater. It's like it took me forever just to get into the place. And yeah, and it's all a joke. A dog stuck its nose in my box full of comics, you know, and held it there for the longest time because I had a sandwich in there, you know? And the guard, the canine handler, he didn't do anything. I thought for sure he was going to say, oh, he must have found a bomb. But no, he found a sandwich. But the guard didn't even care what the dog found. I assume he just looked at me and he saw this old short-haired white guy. Yeah, he's no trouble.
Well, you know, you mentioned earlier, for the past few years, you've been doing a lot of cartoons about being a dad. And one of the most notorious was a short piece called Let's Give Fascism a Chance.
Right.
So what were you thinking?
That was, well, the title, of course, was a total, I was being totally sarcastic. But it was, and it's something that you'd see, it's something that I was much more aware of with young mothers. How like, but I felt it, you know, being the father of a toddler and being new to parenthood, your gut reaction to bad behavior when you're out in public is far less tolerant, you know, because you have this defenseless child to protect. So when you see a bunch of skateboarding kids acting like jerks, normally I would barely give them the time of day. I don't care what they're doing or saying. But when you have this 1-year-old in tow, there is this part of you, this reptile part of your brain, where it's like, skateboards should be banned. You know? And I know so many women who are even, at that time, a lot of young moms. It's like I was making fun of myself. I was just simply acknowledging this overprotective instinct, which I also know leads to bad laws, that unwillingness to take risks, not to want to risk anything, and just want to live in a bubble and not to have anybody impede on your life. And this obsession with safety, which has only gotten worse, that was the type of soft fascism that I was making fun of. But I was the point of the strip was that I feel that. I know what you're talking about. But a lot of, especially women I knew, they were like, no, I'm not going to apologize for it. They go, yeah, I used to be super duper liberal in the real sense of the world. I was very live and live, very, very tolerant. And now that I'm a mom, I'm not tolerant anymore. I can't stand this crap. You know, I want everything to be all safe and lovely and perfect, mainly for my young child. And if anybody betrays all these laws that I want enacted, they should go straight to prison. And I don't care what happens to them. I want my child to experience nothing negative. And that's an impulse. Well, it's a human impulse, but it's something that, when translated into law, has gotten worse and worse.
You've got this trilogy of graphic biographies, and I just want to know, what led you to tackle the histories of radical women from the turn of the last century?
Well, that is a really long answer. I'll try to be concise about it. I basically had already started doing these short 1, 2, 3, 5, 8-page comic strips about historical figures, founding fathers and scientists, things like that. And I was really enjoying doing these biographical strips. And it reached the point that I both was ready, willing, and able to do a full-length biography. Around that same time, for reasons that are difficult to get into, I became very interested in certain, they might have been activists or authors, artists, but certain creative, energetic women whose most productive period would have been between the two world wars. And what struck me, what I found very interesting about their lives, is these women did whatever they wanted to do. It almost seemed like they were more advanced mentally than women are now. They were utterly fearless. They did whatever the heck they wanted to do. And this was in the 1920s and 30s. And they were, even though if you'd asked them, they would all describe themselves as feminists. They didn't wear that term on their sleeves. They weren't self-consciously feminist. They weren't self-conscious about being female. What all they were conscious of was the work they wanted to do, the work that they wanted to get done, and how to achieve that end. And as a result, they led amazing lives. Well, nobody is completely fearless. Zora Neale Hurston, for example, had her own fears and insecurities, but none of those fears and insecurities translated into keeping her from doing what she wanted to do. She was very passionate about her interests, which was anthropology, and her anthropological interests totally revolved around the African diaspora, mainly Africans who, in America, African Americans, but also in the Caribbean, and just wanted to celebrate where they were coming from. She was a very early, her and Langston Hughes were early and unapologetic advocates of the notion of black pride, mainly fighting the notion that it's lesser, that black culture is a lesser culture, basically fighting white supremacy, you know. And for a while, when she started out, you could argue that she was advocating black supremacy, that it was better. And it was an understandable impulse that she had of this either-or attitude between white culture and black culture that she later realized that's a go-nowhere argument.
But mainly you liked her attitude of just dealing with people who came up against her.
Right. And also, you know, she and her life philosophy, how she believes people should get along, how people should be left alone. Her life philosophy, which translated into politics, is identical to mine. So that was another thing, too. I was familiar with her writing first, Their Eyes Are Watching God, and also her autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Road. And I loved them. To this day, I can't remember how I wound up reading them. You know, if somebody suggested it, I don't know what, but I loved it. And then the more I read about her and her life, reading her biographies, the more I admired her. But yeah, I just wanted to celebrate these women who accomplished great things and also had interesting lives. It was like stuff to draw, stuff to write about. You know, I could easily do a graphic novel about an author who just wrote great stuff, like a J.D. Salinger, let's say. But, you know, most of his life, he was sitting behind a typewriter, and then the last 30 years of his life, he didn't even write and just watched TV all day. It just would make for a very boring graphic novel, you know. But these women did stuff. They were all over the world, doing all kinds of crazy crap, getting arrested, you know.
And the other two books are Credo, which we mentioned, about Rose Wilder Lane, and Woman Rebel, about Margaret Sanger. She's credited as being the founder of Planned Parenthood. Now, she's a more problematic figure. She's hated by right-wingers for being an early supporter of birth control, and she's become radioactive on the left for flirting with eugenics.
Right. A lot of the negative stuff that leftists believe, it's either totally made up, or quotes that she didn't make but are attributed to her, or quotes that she did make that were totally taken out of context, all designed to outrage people on the left. All of these lies and distortions are from the right, from the religious right. The eugenic stuff, it's a really complicated, all that stuff, it's so hard to get into, but she was not a racist. Her association she had with the eugenics movement, which I have to tell you was mainstream, that was everybody. Everybody that went to college believed in eugenics. And also, you and I believe in eugenics because it had to do with, for example, prenatal care. Who's against prenatal care? That was part of the eugenics movement. It was just simply making a healthier next generation. And that's why when somebody says, well, wasn't Margaret Sanger, didn't she believe in eugenics? To a certain degree, and so did literally everybody. The only intellectuals that didn't were very devout Catholics, like Chesterton, people like that. And that was few and far between. I really thought with my stupid comic book that I could have stemmed this tidal wave of lies. But people are so eager to believe the worst about everybody. You hear something horrible about Margaret Sanger, whether you're on the right or the left, you automatically believe it because you read it on the internet. You find it hard to believe that somebody could have simply made it up. But it's all either fiction or distortions, and it's like I'm fighting this incredible losing battle when it comes to her, and I feel like I'm fighting it by myself, you know? Oh, Margaret Sanger, Mrs. Abortion, the inventor of abortion, and people might even say that sarcastically, but it's like, she was against abortion. How many times do I have to say that? But everybody thinks she's the abortion queen, you know?
Well, so what's next for you? Got any dream projects coming up?
It's very torturous. I still every day think I won't do it, but the next project, if anything, would be a memoir about my late brother. I had an older brother, Doug, who, when we were young, he was a cartoonist and very naturally gifted, a very funny cartoonist, and he was a big inspiration of mine. But his life took a fairly tragic turn. So it's very personal. It's something he died like 23 years ago. And ever since then, I've wanted to do a memoir about him. It'd basically be about my relationship with him. It'd be about the two of us. But some of my family members are not too crazy about this idea. So I don't know. I might not do it. We'll see. But I'm still doing lots of stuff for Reason Magazine, things like that.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guest today has been illustrator, editor, and comics artist, Peter Bagg. Pete, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. This was great.
And many thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You can find an archived version of the show, along with extended versions, later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter, @wordsandpicture.